we're not going to do something that's not in the best interest of Alaskans just to save some money on a special session.
Legislative overtime in Juneau costs the state up to $30,000 per day. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, May 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, UAF has a new chancellor, and he faces some tough decisions on his first day on campus.
We've made some mistakes, and we've got some budget challenges, but we'll get through those.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. At Alaska Pacific University, students are surrounded by beauty, distinguished faculty, and independent-minded creative students pursuing higher education. AlaskaPacific.edu, moving life forward with APU. This message sponsored by Alaska Pacific University.
Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke is visiting Alaska this weekend. He's traveling with Alaska's congressional delegation and four other U.S. senators on a trip to Alaska, Greenland, and Norway. They will land in Fairbanks, and the secretary will visit Denali National Park on Sunday and Monday. He'll be in Anchorage Tuesday and Wednesday. Among his plans are to speak at an Alaska Oil and Gas Association conference and hike to the Nike site in Arctic Valley. The Interior Department is responsible for managing about half of Alaska's land mass in national parks, refuges, and other federal ownership. As secretary, Zinke also oversees the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The cost of going past the 90-day legislative session set by state law is roughly $1 million and rising. However, lawmakers can legally have a session of up to 120 days, as they did this year, because it is written into the state constitution. The additional costs are driven by the daily allowances that lawmakers receive for each day of the extra legislative time, known as a per diem, and the continuing cost of paying their aides' salaries. Senate President Pete Kelly says the expense must be understood in the context of the major issues the legislature is attempting to resolve and the total cost of state government.
We certainly don't want to cave in on issues that maybe are not in the best interest of Alaska, simply to save, you know, a few dollars here and there in comparison with how much is spent overall.
The regular 120-day session ended on May 17th. Governor Bill Walker then called lawmakers into legislative overtime. The cost of the additional 31 days of the special session is not yet calculated, but it is expected to be higher than the $700,000 it cost last year for a similar extension. That's because more legislative aides are working this year and per diems went up. Lawmakers who represent areas outside Juneau receive nearly $300 for each day of the special session. Juneau lawmakers receive 25% less per day. Some lawmakers say they won't claim per diems for each day of extra time. Anchorage Independent Jason Gren says he won't claim per diem during the entire special session. Today was the ninth day. Past special sessions have cost between $20,000 and $30,000 per day. Kelly says he expects the cost of the special session to be lower on the Senate side of the legislature this year. That's because the Senate is trying to reduce the number of aides in Juneau.
As a diligent manager, I'm sending as many people home as I can to save on those costs. But we're not going to do something that's not in the best interest of Alaskans just to save some money on a special session.
Another cost for the special session is the housing expenses for legislative aides. 25 House aides have been approved for housing this month, with costs ranging from $25 to $129 per day. Aides say the beginning of tourism season has raised housing costs in Juneau. The aides must provide receipts to be reimbursed. Relatives of deceased members of a largely Alaska Native citizen militia who guarded the U.S. territory during World War II have received Army discharge papers meant as a posthumous honor. The family members of 16 volunteers from the Alaska Territorial Guard were given the papers during a ceremony today in Anchorage. Nearly 2,600 discharge papers have been issued since 2004 as militia members or relatives are found or apply for them. In 1942, before Alaska was a state, the 6,400-member militia was formed to defend the territory from the threat of Japanese invasion. The unit disbanded in 1947, but its members weren't recognized by the Army until 2004. The University of Alaska Fairbanks has a new chancellor. Yesterday, University of Alaska President Jim Johnson announced that Daniel White would lead the Interior campus. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, White takes the helm during troubled times for the school.
Incoming UAF Chancellor Dan White acknowledges challenges lie before him. The school, along with other campuses in the UA system, has been undergoing belt tightening in the face of reduced state funding. And this year, the Alaska Senate proposes slashing another $22 million from the UA system. At the same time, UAF's reputation has been tarred by Title IX violations. Nevertheless, White, who was at a Rotary luncheon Thursday, says he's confident moving forward.
We've made some mistakes and we've got some budget challenges, but we'll get through those. I'm committed to working on that, as I know many at the university are.
Currently, White serves as UA Vice President for Academic Affairs and Research. He began his career at UAF in 1995 as a professor of civil and environmental engineering. Over the years, he's filled a number of posts, including Director of the Institute of Northern Engineering and Mines and Associate Vice Chancellor for Research. UAF has seen a pair of interim chancellors since Brian Rogers stepped down 2 years ago. An earlier search was stopped as the statewide system eyed a single accreditation process, which later proved impractical. UA President Jim Johnson says White's breadth of experience elevated him to the top of the latest search.
Breadth in terms of his experience in the classroom teaching, in terms of his experience in laboratories and in the field conducting research, and in his connections with the communities that we serve all across the state.
Johnson says White also has a depth of knowledge, having lived and worked in Fairbanks for so long. White takes up his duties July 1st. His salary will be $300,000 a year. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, documenting the Yupik names of places around Alaska's largest and most productive lake, Iliamna.
It's not just a place name, but it's a story behind the places.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration provide information on passengers' rights and responsibilities. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
Two Interior residents are missing after a boating accident on the Yukon River. Alaska State Troopers report that a search is underway for 56-year-old Clifford Adams and 38-year-old I. Adams, both residents of the Yukon Flats village of Beaver. Troopers say a third person, 45-year-old Kim Anden of Rampart, was found walking along the river on Wednesday. Anden said she and the Adamses were returning to Beaver from a hunting trip on Sunday when their boat overturned about 6 miles downstream of the village. Anden told troopers the last time she saw the Adamses, they were unresponsive, and that she was the only one wearing a life jacket when the boat flipped over. Search efforts for the Adamses include boats and a helicopter. A man who rammed police vehicles with his truck was shot dead by Fairbanks police officers yesterday in Fairbanks. The man, whose name has not been released, had outstanding felony arrest warrants, according to Alaska State Troopers. Trooper Lieutenant Brian Wassman says officers tried to stop the man yesterday afternoon on the old Richardson Highway.
The suspect failed to stop and then led the Alaska State Troopers on a pursuit, which went down the Richardson Highway towards North Pole. Witnesses reported to the state troopers that the suspect fired a gun at pursuing troopers.
Lieutenant Wassman says Fairbanks police deployed spike strips that deflated the tires on the suspect's truck. Wassman says that didn't stop the man, who then pulled onto a Mitchell Expressway on-ramp,
where he encountered Fairbanks police officers and Alaska State Troopers. The suspect then proceeded to ram an occupied Fairbanks Police Department vehicle and an Alaska State Trooper vehicle. Fairbanks police officers then discharged their weapons, hitting the suspect and injuring him.
Wassman says officers provided first aid and the suspect was transported to the hospital, where he later died. Alaska State Troopers are investigating the shooting. As is police policy, the names of the officers involved are being withheld for 72 hours. Beginning June 12th, management of king salmon on the lower and middle Kuskokwim River will switch from state to federal control. KYUK's Anna Rose MacArthur reports the Alaska Department of Fish and Game will hand over management to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
If you're a fisherman, you shouldn't see much difference. When the switch happens, the king salmon fishery will close, but these areas are already closed under state management, and the same handoff has happened since the summer following the poor king salmon return of 2013. That's because, by federal law, the service has to take over the fishery in times of low abundance to ensure that local people get subsistence priority. The portion of the river switching management lies within the Yukon Delta National Wildlife Refuge, from Aniak down to the mouth of the Kuskokwim. Depending on how the run is doing, the feds will allow gillnet fishing openings. Refuge manager Ken Stahlnecker says they've already got one planned on that day,
which is looking like it may end up being a 12-hour opportunity on the 12th of June.
So that's guaranteed to happen?
Like I said, we're trying to finalize things. So I wouldn't say it's a guarantee at this moment, but that is definitely what we're talking about.
And Stahlnecker expects to allow more fishing opportunities than last year. The run forecast looks the same as the previous year, so managers are designating the same amount for subsistence harvest, about 40,000 kings. Last year, fishermen hit below that.
We probably harvested about 30,000. So we ended up being a little bit more conservative than what our management objective was.
The rules will also be the same as last year. Openings under federal law will be restricted to local subsistence users living on the Kuskokwim River drainage or along the coast in Chefornik, Congiganak, Kipnuk, or Quigillinock. And the gear restrictions will be familiar too.
Again, exactly what they were last year.
6-inch mesh, no more than 45 meshes deep or 50 fathoms in length.
From the mouth of the Kuskokwim River at the boundary of the refuge up to the Johnson River.
And upstream from there, restrictions change.
From the Johnson River up to the boundary at Aniak, they can be no longer than 25 fathoms.
The restrictions are meant to conserve the Kuskokwim King Salmon Run, which is projected to hit below the historic average again this season. The restrictions apply to the Kuskokwim River main stem and to the following salmon-bearing tributaries within the refuge: the Eek, Queethluk, Kasigluk, Kizaraluk, Tuluksak, and Aniak. In Bethel, I'm Anna Rose MacArthur.
For years, locals have needed a permit to hike the Termination Point Trail on Kodiak. But now they can explore that property without a fee. KMXT's Kayla DeRoche has the story.
This spring, the Native Corporation Lesnoy passed along the land's conservation easement to the Kodiak Island Borough. That means that land development is now prohibited and the property is open to public access. Land conservation nonprofit, the Great Lands Trust, arranged the transfer of the easement with funding from the Exxon Valdez Oil Spill Trustee Council. The Great Lands Trust Executive Director, Ellen Kazari, says the organization finds habitats that the Exxon Valdez oil spill impacted. The ones that are most in need of protection are bumped up to the top of the list.
And Termination Point, almost 20 years ago, was identified by the community of Kodiak and then reaffirmed with this prioritization as a high priority, valuable piece of property with great habitat, wetlands, coastal shoreline, and recreation opportunities, which was also an impacted measure, as a high priority to protect with conservation.
The Great Lands Trust had been looking for a group to hold the easement when it approached the borough a couple of years ago. Kazari says now that the deal is done, Lesnoy still owns the land, but it sold its development rights.
And that's what the conservation easement is to conserve the habitat value. You can't clear cut, you can't subdivide. So they've sold those possible development rights. the Kodiak Island Borough then basically takes on the role of manager of the public use of the land.
The same partners are also working on transferring the conservation easement to Long Island. Kazari says right now they're working on details around the environmental review, a standard part of land deals. She says Long Island is a former military site and they need to find any possible contaminants before moving forward. I'm Kayla DeRoche.
In recognition of its Athabascan name, the official name of Mount McKinley was changed to Mount Denali in 2015. A University of Alaska Fairbanks PhD candidate in anthropology has taken an interest in Native place names. Yoko Kugo is in the midst of a three-year project to document the Yupik names of places around Iliamna Lake. KDLG's Avery Lill has more.
Is that on the USGS map, Slushy Creek?
A creek runs into the river at the base of a bluff along the Kwijak. At the top of the hill, grass-covered pits mark the foundation of old buildings, evidence of an abandoned settlement. It likely has a Yupik name, and Kugo is hoping to find out from elders in the nearby village of Igiagig what it is.
I ask them about the place names, also how they used to get there, what time of the year they went there. So it's not just a place name, but it's a story behind the places.
Kugo photographs the creek, house pits, an old cross that would have marked a grave, and a metal bell that lies in the dirt. She'll take those photos back to the village. From there, she'll interview elders about the area's history and about what the creek, site, and artifacts are called in their native language.
Then the goal is to make a Nambahpak, Iliamna Lake place name map, the whole Iliamna Lake region. Also want to make a database for the place name that each community, they can keep the database.
In Igiagig, Kugo's work dovetails with the work of the village council president, Alexander Salmon. Salmon has dedicated years to recording the history and Yupik names of places around the village where she grew up.
It's just learning about how the Yupik oriented themselves and what they chose to name and why. So there's a lot of cultural, ecological knowledge that are in those place names, as well as for some people, family history that would be lost without having recorded that.
To underline the importance of native place names, Salmon points out that they can be key to understanding how the area has changed over time.
A lot of times the place names were places where they harvested certain resources, like Naruyatuli, an island that was known for all of its seagull eggs. If you went back there today and saw that there were no seagulls, that would tell you another story. Well, thousands of years ago, there must have been a lot of seagulls here, but today there aren't any. So what's happened?
Kugo's research will broaden the context for the work already done in Igiagig. Salmon is excited that Kugo is bringing that energy to other villages around Iliamna Lake.
Yoko is just expanding what we've done to the whole region, which is extremely wonderful because Kakanak and Leavelock and Iliamna New Halen, they're our cousin villages. So now we'll have the whole picture rather than just our piece from our elders.
Since Kugo began the project last summer for her dissertation fieldwork, she has visited New Halen, Iliamna, Kakanak, and Igiagig. In those villages, she's interviewed more than a dozen people. Kugo has funding from the National Science Foundation to continue for 2 more years. When she's finished, she plans to create a physical map and an online database of place names and their histories for the communities that she studies. In Dillingham, I'm Avery Lill.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're a K-12 teacher, consider the University of Alaska Southeast Juneau campus for Summer in the Rainforest continuing education courses. 2 sessions offered, Basic and Beyond Arts Institute, July 24th through 29th, and Indigenous Arts Institute, July 30th through August 4th. Stipends, scholarships, and on-campus housing are available. Learn more at uas.alaska.edu/summerrain. This message is sponsored by UAS.
Ketchikan,
Kotzebue,
Dillingham,
Sitka,
Chugiak,
Fairbanks,
Fort Yukon,
Wrangell,
Barrow,
Unalaska, Dutch Harbor,
Alaknarechamut.
This is AK on Alaska News Nightly. I'm Dave Waldron. This week on AK, fire cops. When a fire breaks out, it's not always obvious how it started. Not only could the entire structure be wiped out, but items that started the fire could be altered or completely destroyed. That's the job of the fire investigator: interview witnesses and find clues at the scene to determine how the fire started. KTOO's Matt Miller attended a recent training exercise in Juneau and has this story.
Tell us what happened.
This is ridiculous. Absolutely sucks.
An apartment in Juneau just burned up yesterday. After dousing the fire, firefighters put most of the occupants' wet and smoldering belongings out in the front yard.
Hey, we don't pay a lot in rent here, you know. It's kind of crappy stuff here, but it's all we can afford.
It's all of our possessions.
The apartment's occupants are back at the scene, agitated and upset, but talking to a fire investigator.
Was the lamp plugged in when you left? Was it on?
Yeah, I usually always keep the lamp on.
The investigator will go inside, look for evidence, then he'll take all the stuff in the front yard and put it back in the apartment. He'll try to recreate the scene before it burned.
Hey, I want you to figure out what happened here, because this ain't right.
This may sound like it's real, but it's only a training exercise at the Hagavig Regional Fire Training Center in Juneau. Students are questioning instructors who are role-playing the burned-out couple. In real life, something like this scene may happen 3 times a day across Alaska. According to the latest state figures, there were nearly 1,470 structure fires in 2015 that killed 16 people and injured 83. Total damage estimated at $49 million. As much as 5% of those fires were intentionally started. And that's where the fire investigator comes in. They determine the origin and the cause of the fire and whether it was intentionally or unintentionally set.
We don't call fires accidental anymore, because the accidental has the connotation that it was not a preventable type thing.
Ernie Misiewicz is chief of the Sulcha Fire Department and president of the Alaska Association of Arson and Fire Investigators.
Any fire that we have has its own indicators. And so we look at all the potential causes for fires: smoking, unattended cooking, electrical heating systems. And so as we go through our fire scenes, we're looking for these potential causes and then ruling them out.
Indicators of an electrical fire, for example, would include a burned or melted electrical outlet that had power to it.
Fire investigation is like learning a new language. Initially, it's very difficult, but once you start mastering it, it becomes even kind of fun.
John Gamboa, a retired special agent and fire investigator with the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms in Chicago, teaches new and experienced investigators.
Fire behavior, fire chemistry, fire modeling, scene processing, evidence collection. We teach them a multitude of disciplines, so hopefully we'll make them better fire investigators, and they'll learn from our experience and from other individuals that come here to teach them on how to approach a fire systematically.
Now we're talking.
Of course, there's classroom work, but the training also includes students putting their knowledge to the test. 6 rooms are built outside of the training center. Each room is furnished and stocked with clothes and other personal belongings. A fire is started in each room and then put out by firefighters. Student investigators arrive the next day to figure out what happened. The crew, led by North Slope Borough Fire Department Battalion Chief Mauricio Gueco, discover a couch that was doused with accelerant and ignited by a road flare. An end table in the room was undamaged, so they get a search warrant before opening the table drawer, and they find a diary that describes how the resident had been threatened by someone.
The diary will definitely come into play. Same with the flare, the couch. We still have some homework to do. You know, we have to see if the flare can actually ignite that couch, do those tests.
Jason Martirosian, formerly with the Chicago Fire Department and the Department of Homeland Security, frequently pulls me aside to interpret the language that Gamboa uses, like reading a burn trail left by a liquid accelerant, or how a missing picture frame or a bookcase can leave telltale burn and smoke shadows.
What do you call either protected areas or witness marks on the floor?
Right. And remember that couple who got burned out of their apartment earlier? After looking at burn patterns, students determined that everything was piled up in the center of the room before the fire started. A small plastic garbage bin had melted into a chair's framework.
What could an insurance company budget do to this if we have a solid molten mass like
that? They package the whole thing up and take it to their lab.
And what might they do? Did you guys talk about it in your class that they might be able to, like, x-ray this?
Action testing, yeah.
Was the fire started to conceal a crime? Hard to tell right now. Hopefully the investigator's report will be thorough enough to allow prosecutors to get a conviction. 40 students from around Alaska participated in the training. Some of them, someday, may be trying to figure out how that fire started in your business or your home. For AK, I'm Matt Miller reporting in Juneau.
Now it's time for 49 Voices. This week we're hearing from Eric Boltman of Anchorage. Boltman moved to Alaska after serving in the Air Force and recently participated in the Valdez fly-in.
Alaska. Uh-huh. I just always wanted to be here. And so I got out of the Air Force and we packed everything we owned into a trailer and literally moved up here with some resumes. I was an air weapons officer on the E-3 AWACS. I always had the bug. And especially bush flying. And so as soon as I could afford it, I started getting lessons and then took off about 3 years of flying to start a business and then was finally able to afford my own airplane. It's a 1953 PA-18A Super Cub. So it's an agricultural model. It was originally a crop duster. It was actually kind of, it just came across it. There was a gentleman who was selling it at we were driving through the airport one day and he had it for sale and it had all the modifications I wanted done to it. And it's been a fantastic first airplane. Just a safe, easy to fly, just a good, honest airplane. You know, just tons of little bush strips, you know, learning how to bush fly, all over Kinnick Glacier area. Seward, Homer, you know, just everywhere I can get. But the Cub is slow, so it takes a long time to get there. I mean, you know, of course, Valdez was always, you know, a big one. Love, 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 love coming here. This is like the highlight of my years, coming out here. My first time was in 2011, and, you know, I was walking around as the wannabe, talking to all the pilots and, you know, trying to figure out what airplane I wanted to get. And then brought my own airplane first time last year. I know I'm not trying to, you know, kiss Valdez's butt, but man, I really do. I love it here. I love going out to the beaches. I love the fly-in because it's so cool to talk to other pilots and just spend days out here on the tarmac. We took a whole week off just to come out here.
Eric Boltman lives in Anchorage. 49 Voices is AK's attempt to put every Alaskan on the radio. Thanks for listening to AK this week. We had help from Matt Miller, Tony Gorman, and Wesley Early. Tune in next week for more unique stories from around the state. I'm Dave Waldron.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Andrew Kitchenman in Juneau, Robert Hannon and Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, Kayla DeRoche in Kodiak, and Avery Lill in Dillingham. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Sean Dugan is our editor and producer. Wesley Early is our web editor. And I'm Lori Townsend. Have a great weekend.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
First National Bank Alaska. For nearly a century, First National has been Alaska's community bank. Learn how experience and local knowledge make the difference at fnbalaska.com. Alaska Pacific University offers graduate programs that deliver a distinctive education, grounded in real-world experience with life-friendly schedules to support personal goals. Apply now at alaskapacific.edu. This message sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.